Don't you see you've created a monster?
Can Dracula really be as bold?
What matters is I'm creating a being that will live and breathe,
as we call them. Are so obscure that many biologists will not believe they exist.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren, and we are the Rants Macabre, now part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com. In part one of our Monsters of Hammer series, Mindy and I covered the history of Hammer Film Productions and their evolution from B-movie studio to champions of cult horror.
We followed Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee's beginnings in their groundbreaking roles as Victor Frankenstein and his creature, and Van Helsing and Dracula. In part two of our Hammer series, we'll be rounding out with 1958's The Revenge of Frankenstein,
1959's The Mummy,
1960's The Brides of Dracula,
and finally Oliver Reed's Curse of the Werewolf from 1961. Intercut will be moments from a conversation with Mindy's dad, Mark Lernard, who was a guest on our Universal Monsters installment, which was episode two, and our real-life horror episode, where he spoke about his background as a probation officer dealing with sex offenders and the darker elements of society.
In the year 1860, I, Baron Frankenstein, was sentenced to death on the guillotine. Why had the world condemned me? Because I was the first man to create another living being. The first unnatural man. But because his brain was affected, because he could not control his animal instincts, he was hunted down and brutally murdered. But I have escaped the guillotine. And I shall avenge the death of my creation.
Who is he?
Nobody. He isn't born yet.
In the same year came the sequel to The Curse of Frankenstein. Now we have The Revenge of Frankenstein. And I will say its name is far more aggressive than it actually is, unless you think of Frankenstein's work as being an attack on mankind.
Right.
If you do, then all right, Revenge of
Yay.
Frankenstein. I'm not going to spend too much time on this one. I liked it, but yeah, I mean, it's a sequel. We talked about how the writer...
Right.
was sort of reluctant to go back to the
and
territory.
And I liked how the promo with Peter Cushing where he says, because you know that in the first movie, Frankenstein goes to the guillotine.
On his way to the guillotine, roll credits. Yeah.
And that's the end. And then he says, you may have thought I had gone to the guillotine, but I haven't. And you're like, thanks for that. Thanks for phoning that in for
On
me.
Screen, there might as well be a shoehorn, literally, just
exactly.
We're wedging.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, because I was confused, but now I'm not because you explained it so thoroughly to me.
And at the beginning of the movie, also, the same sort of narration intros the idea that I didn't die, and we get to see this literally on screen because two grave robbers find the body of Dr. Frankenstein, who famously was decapitated and buried here, except it's not him. It's a priest. Now, this I found really bizarre. The description said Frankenstein escaped the guillotine and had a priest beheaded and buried in his place with the aid of some of his followers.
I didn't know he had followers.
He didn't have followers. What, science groupies?
They became really interested in followers and having followers at this time. Because Dracula
the
then
cult
gets...
of Frankenstein.
Yeah, and then there becomes a cult basically associated with Dracula. So I wonder if cult was on the mind. Like, cults were on the mind at that time.
When Frankenstein went to trial, he probably came up with a couple people who are willing to like...
He's like Manson.
Decapitate a priest.
Yeah, put him in
his place.
No problem.
So the grave robbers find him, and of all places, that's where we see the reveal of, like, Frankenstein confronts them.
Right.
And goes like, here I am, alive and well, and one of them seemingly has a heart attack on the spot and falls
him.
In. Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there you go, shoehorn, now we're off to the races.
Yeah, good, now we can start.
Frankenstein has now fled to Germany.
Why not?
To work at like a free clinic, the worst free clinic in all of Germany.
Oh, I know their fees subsidize your work at the poor hospital. I know how good you are to the poor doctor.
This is just like the indigent and downtrodden. These guys are a disaster.
Nice.
But because they're not going to be missed, Frankenstein is seemingly finding excuses to relieve them of body parts.
Sure, fire. Why not? They're not going to miss them.
It becomes apparent that he's been reassembling body parts. He's back to business. Although we don't get to find that out until another doctor recognizes him.
After a few moments with you this afternoon, I was sure I'd seen you before.
And he denies it until finally.
Some other guy.
So this doctor is persistent because he wants in.
I want to learn more than any university can ever teach me. I want to be the pupil of the greatest doctor, the finest medical brain in the world. Your pupil, Baron Frankenstein.
And also Frankenstein's going by either, at one time he's going by like Dr. Frank, and then the other time is like Dr. Stein or something.
Stein.
It's so stupid. Like,
he's
come
reborn,
on,
a nice
dude.
Jewish boy.
Yeah. Like, come on. He's just like really terrible at like hiding.
Well, the fact remains, gentlemen, Dr. Stein must be made to join this council, or steps must be taken to see that he is no longer permitted to practice in this city.
But again, like, his ego won't let him completely, like, yeah, I don't know, call me Mitch. Like,
yeah, he's come just on.
Completely conspicuous. Reintroduce the idea that Frankenstein has had a secret lab. His work is ongoing. However, now he is more obsessed with the idea. He's still stuck on the brain. And even in this movie, he refers to the first experiment going wrong because his fucking friend
not the
damaged
fact that
the
he
brain.
Murdered the man by damaging the brain.
It should have been perfect. I made it to be perfect. If the brain hadn't been damaged, my work would have been hailed as the greatest scientific achievement of all time.
So he's getting very good at replacing brains, and he's done so in a chimp, which they call a monkey several times, which is just a sticking point for me. I don't know why it bothers me, but no tail. It was a chimp.
Okay, fair enough. I wouldn't care about that.
But he's getting better and better at brain surgery. That's become his obsession. I don't want to linger on this story too much, but there is the theme of his sort of crippled assistant who isn't mentally incompetent, but he is, you know, he's got like a wonky arm and a limp.
You mean Carl?
Yes. We made a bargain. If he saved me from the guillotine, I would give him a new body.
Yes, but his paralysis, surely that indicates an injury to the brain.
I examine him thoroughly. The paralysis is due to a blood clot. It can be dispersed during the operation. Carl has a fine brain. He's quick, intelligent, and he's absorbed a great deal of knowledge since working with me. Haven't you, Carl?
Dr. Stein is welcome to my brain.
And that body starts to fail him because they sort of play on the idea that any limitation is that of the brain, and your body will sort of follow.
Okay, fair enough.
And so that's kind of the horror of this particular story, that the guy, you know, they play on the idea that, like, he wasn't given full time to rest and recuperate.
Maybe Frankenstein should have really looked into robotics. And, like, well, so he can put the brain in a robot body.
I'm sure if Hammer kept making movies, they would have gone there.
Yeah, that's what needed to happen.
80s, like, robo Frankenstein.
Then you'd have, like,
totally
a robot smashing into shit.
So that's now the guy that they're sort of chasing down, is the former assistant whose body is failing him. And as a result, he is embittered and freaking out and killing people. And yeah, I didn't want to linger on this story too much because there's more exciting stuff. It was a decent sequel, and it's certainly well reviewed in terms of the Hammer movies. But more interestingly is The Mummy in 1959.
Right. And I actually did like this one.
If you persist in continuing with this operation, I cannot answer for the consequences.
This is interesting because I, at the time we were doing the Universal ones, I recounted this one pretty quickly because it was so bad.
But this was very good. This was more like an adventure. I felt like it really reminded me of Indiana Jones. And I liked it a lot. I really, really liked it. I thought, I mean, obviously there's some really stupid parts about it, but I really liked it on the whole.
It's funny, but in the theme where, like, Indiana Jones is committed to finding treasure and putting it in a museum outside of its country of origin.
Right.
These guys are essentially tomb raiders.
Yes.
They are, yeah, working for, like, the British Museum or whatever, but there they are in Egypt just plundering the tomb of
this ancient
mummy.
And they're not, you know,
mummy.
Remembering the ancient saying, which seems like everyone should remember that ancient saying.
Mr. Benning, You would do well to remember the ancient saying, Hal ye sirk min kapr misr etwafa. He who robs the graves of Egypt dies.
Yeah, don't forget this ancient saying, which I say all the time. Like, I find myself saying that probably like 5 times a week.
A little bit of a nod. Actually, I think at this point, they had squared away with Universal.
Yeah, they had this. Could so they could use certain things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this movie actually closely mirrors The Mummy's Tomb. And in doing so, they also a little bit play homage to the early moments in the original Mummy film where the character is sort of driven mad. So mm-hmm. Peter Cushing's dad, in this case, is the sort of head archaeologist who happens off camera, but right. like he sees something that literally scares him hysterical.
Right, right.
And in the original movie, the guy is laughing like a maniac as if the mummy before leaving told him the greatest joke ever.
Funny joke. The Aristocrats or something.
What's the matter? For heaven's sakes, what is it?
He went for a little walk. You should have seen his face.
So in this one, they get his dad out of there. They take a couple things and then decide that, like, so no one ever goes back in there. We'll just explode the entrance.
Yes, with the world's, like, longest fuse also. Did you notice? The fuse is so freaking long.
I placed a charge 12 feet along the tunnel to bring the roof down.
But I noticed, too, and I made a note of how the Egyptians actually seem to be terrible workers, the Egyptians that are working with the English people.
Why do you say that?
Because one guy is literally just hitting a rock with a hammer.
Oh, he's doing like background acting?
Yeah, he's just hitting a rock. And then other people are like doing relatively nothing. They're the worst workers ever. I wouldn't want them on my team. And old boy hitting rock with hammer, that's not what we do. Everyone knows archaeologists use like that dusty brush.
Yeah.
You don't just crack it with
but
a mallet.
This is also the day and age where they're just satisfied not to preserve a site, but to explode it so no one else can steal from it. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but that moment's kind of a little bit of exposition. My dad is back home and healing or whatever, letting his brain rest.
But then he never goes to visit him. So it's been 3 years.
When Father first went into the nursing home, they said if there was no improvement in 6 months, there never would be.
They may be wrong, you know. They know very little about mental illness.
And Peter Cushing is such a bad son, he never goes to visit his father until his father asks for him.
Right. Well, it seems like his dad is even not cognizant enough to like recognize him as a son.
Yeah, but you still go visit your family that you've put them in the, what was the home called? It's called like something terrible.
Oh, it's the, yes, the day and age where they had just like home for the
mentally disturbed or some shit is where they put him. And so you don't go visit your family apparently. Peter Cushing's a terrible son. Also of note though, he has a funny leg because
He was stubborn. Right. He doesn't really let it set. In the very intro to his character, he's already out of commission. He's hurt his leg. They're in Egypt. Any number of things could have gone wrong.
I've worked in dozens of tombs. Best part of my life's been spent amongst the dead. But I've never worked in a place that had such an aura of menace. There's something evil in there, Uncle Joe. I felt it.
Incidentally, Christopher Lee got actually hurt a number of times in the making of this movie. So while Peter Cushing is sort of playing up, and you've noted that
occasionally playing up that his leg is fucked up.
His limp comes and goes. But Christopher Lee, I've got a list of things that happen to Christopher Lee. Okay, so we don't actually get introduced to Christopher Lee as the mummy. He never has any like FaceTime actually, but there he is at 6'4", this sort of towering mummy figure. Gets injured a number of times. A door that Christopher Lee was supposed to crash through was accidentally bolted by a grip before
the scene was shot.
Wouldn't
you be so mad at that guy?
I'd be fucking furious.
Right?
Because also, like, your face is covered up. You can barely see, and you're just banging into bolted doors. His shoulder was dislocated when he broke down that door, but the shot is still in the movie.
Right.
Speaking of shots, when Peter Cushing fired a shotgun at him twice with a, you know, full-barreled shotgun, the squibs, and I remember recognizing it at the time that, like, really impressive stunt work.
Yeah.
The squibs explode on Christopher Lee and just, like, it looks like real damage. And he's a goddamn trooper. And he's, I mean, he's a monster through and through.
Because he doesn't want it anymore. He's like, if we don't continue on with this, this is going to be a problem.
Those squibs were so explosive, they left burns and bruises right. on his chest for the rest of the filming. Later, there's a swamp scene where he's in the studio tank area and bangs his legs, yeah. and, like, hurts his knee and his shins on pipes under the water.
I told you, Inspector, he was bandaged. There was just a slit for his eyes. The rest of him was covered.
I think it had to have been, like, the funniest, like, inner monologue, because, you know, he's just, like, running into shit, and he's like, damn it.
He's like, I don't even have fucking lines in this movie. <Yeah. laughs>
But the whole time I was thinking, like, when I saw Peter Cushing with that limp and everything, I thought, I hope there's a chase scene between him and the mummy, like, with the gimp leg and then the mummy, but never, like, really happened, and I was disappointed in that. There's no really good chase scene.
Although it does bear mention that, so in the original one, Karloff isn't really, you see, like, the mummy walking out of a room, but otherwise they sort of allude with Karloff as this, like, wrinkly faced guy, but he's not the mummy in any scenes where he's actually choking people out or anything. Whereas Christopher Lee is actually quite agile as the mummy. He gets around.
For getting hit in the shin so much.
So he kind of serves as the assassin of the guy who gave them the warning in the first place.
Those unbelievers who disturb the rest of your handmaiden, the Princess Ananka, shall suffer for their blasphemy.
And that said, like, these are individual missions. So the guy first sends them to go get the dad.
Right.
And he does. And he breaks through the window and he chokes out the dad. Shortly after they discover the body, they kind of have this, like, it seems like a hospital-wide meeting where they explain, like,
the very nature of this deed points to the fact that it was committed by some homicidal maniac. And if it were not for the evidence of forced entry, I would have no hesitation in telling the doctor of the nursing home to look among his own inmates.
Because Mummy doesn't know how to use doorknobs at all. He just rams through things.
Oh, so that mention of the homicidal maniac actually reminds me that the idea of mental illness comes up a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And whether it was on purpose or not, I thought it was really interesting that it is a repeat theme.
As you know, he was driven out of his mind.
Homicidal maniac.
When my uncle found him, father's mind was completely unbalanced. He never recovered.
So cut back to Peter Cushing trying to make heads or tails out of why his dad would be murdered in his in his mental hospital room.
But, yeah, and then though they're saying, like, Peter Cushing's going through his dad's bills, and he's like, my dad never paid his bills on time. That was such a weird scene about how his dad just sucked at paying bills. And that was like almost 10 minutes, and then we got this long throwback scene.
Oh, right. He's telling the officer.
But we watch it, and it's about 30 minutes of a flashback. And then when it's all said and done, it's like, but we know it wasn't all true. Again, is a situation like that. And I said, but why'd I have to watch that?
Maybe edit as you tell the story.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what's going on here?
All right, Inspector. I believe the intruder was a mummy, a living mummy.
If I was the cop, I'd be pissed. I'd be like, why did you bother telling me all of that if none of it's pertinent?
Yeah.
Mr. Benny, are you trying to tell me that these two murders were committed by a dead man?
And about this time in the movie, there is one scene, though, that it's, like, really, really great. It's there's these two drunk characters that have shenanigans that go on throughout the
right. One of them witnesses the mummy walking by.
Yeah, because he dropped the freaking mummy box into the bog.
Oh, right.
And the guy with the fez, the bad guy, he says,
these guys were,
that's okay. They were just relics.
Mm. Right. Their job was to ship.
But they were drinking and driving horses. And so the thing falls in the bog. And then the guy says, it's all right. It's just some relics. Like that. And there's no, like, anything. But later, one of those guys, and one of the drunk guys, comes into the bar. And there's a scene with drunk guy number two, stranger number one, and bartender. And that bartender is the only one that's using like a modern day natural style of acting. And it's the most out of place scene that I've ever seen in the movie. I don't know why the scene is even there.
It's funny. Most of these movies use drunks as the comic relief. Like, right. Later in the Brides of Dracula,
the guy's not, he doesn't seem sober, I'll say that. But yeah, it's always drunks who are kind of the go-to, like, goofs.
Right, and these ones seem to have, like, an Irish sort of accent that's, like, put on, and it's really bad.
British kind of shitting on the Irish.
Exactly, but they're really xenophobic about foreigners coming in.
And it comes up again when the detective, I'm trying to think. Oh, I think they get shipping information about where this
stuff. Oh, that's right. And he's like, well, they can learn from our universities, but you can't breed that out of them or something.
Well, he talks about the guy who moved into the neighborhood who's Egyptian. And he's just like, in this neighborhood?
Exactly.
It's like, holy shit,
Peter
Cushing.
Well, they can go to our universities, but there's generations or whatever of this old ways or some shit. And you're like,
neighborhood's going to hell.
Like, what is going on right now? It's very, like, xenophobic. But, I mean, that guy was bad, so I don't know.
Maybe there's something to that.
He was wearing a fez, so you knew he was bad. Which also makes me think, why? Why was he so bad?
Why was the guy bad getting revenge? Yeah. Well, because, I mean, that's murder. What do you mean? He's using the mummy as a gun.
Yeah, but why is he so mad at them in the first place? Oh, why is he?
Because they plundered, well, on site,
but they didn't. They closed it back up.
Yeah, but they took the scroll that the father, Peter Cushing's not around to see it, but he kind of assumes his dad read the like enchantment, the spell to bring the mummy back to life. And at the site, that guy, I wish I remembered his name, but the sort of head Egyptian guy who gives him the stern warning, the ancient proverb.
Yeah, sure. The one we all use and know.
He prays and promises that he will get revenge on all who plundered that tomb.
But why?
I don't know.
Just doesn't like it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what are these Brits doing taking our shit?
Okay.
It's, you know, it's anti-colonialist. There you go.
Fair enough. Okay, I'll take that. I'll accept that. That's acceptable.
Down the line, when it becomes apparent that Christopher Lee's his obsession with the original, you know, whose tomb it was, was the woman
Ananka.
He mistakes Peter Cushing's bride for her.
Right, because she's the same actress.
But only recognizable when her hair is down.
Right. So when the mummy, he's cool with her when her hair is down because he thinks it's this chick because he's easily confused. But when her hair is up, it's like all bets are off.
Right. He's got face blindness.
Yes. Absolutely.
Peter Cushing is literally being strangled when he needs the distraction. His bride comes in, sees him being strangled. He has enough throat clearance to tell his wife, take your hair down.
Yeah, dummy.
So he can see you and stop killing me.
Except for it's more like take your hair down so he stops killing me and captures you and takes you to the swamp.
Yeah, he didn't see that one coming.
Sorry.
So down the line, he does chase her down. It's funny. Like, we're teasing and we're making fun, but this is actually a solid flick.
No, I really liked it. I mean, but there is, like, funny things about it. There's really funny things about it, but I really did like it.
We watch Christopher Lee sweep her up and, like, you know, his towering, he really does walk away with her in his arms, like, pretty smoothly. Down the line, they wind up at this bog where, you know,
he hits his shins
started
on everything.
From. Peter Cushing tells his wife, you have to ask him to put you down. He'll only listen to you.
Mm-hmm. Isabel, tell him to put you down. Tell him, Isabel, quickly.
The bog is surrounded by the cops with guns. They're ready to unload.
Right.
And so she...
They want to shoot the mummy, though, while she's in his arms. He's like, don't do that. Please don't shoot my wife.
So she does say,
Caris, put me down.
However, he's an ancient Egyptian mummy. He doesn't speak fuck all of English.
He's really good at English.
I guess, you know, he read her eyes. But, I mean, no, she had to say the word. She had to tell him, put me down.
Yeah, he didn't know she didn't want to be carried around the bog.
So go figure.
But also, this is the same bog that they're walking in that the casket or the box that contained the mummy in the first place got lost in. And the constable goes, oh, we'll probably never find it down there. So this is the same, but she just walks through it. It's knee deep and you guys couldn't fucking find a box in there.
They didn't have, you know, like modern scuba guys to dredge the thing. What I did like is, this is a weird pull, but in Bubba Hotep, when the mummy that's like touring the country just goes into the drink, like I kind of figured that, yeah, that was an homage to some movie, but there you go.
Right, that's right. From
these movies. So he's kind of returning to his resting place and he's going to drown her if he doesn't let her go. She gets him to let him go and they unload and shoot the shit out of Christopher Lee's mummy.
Which it didn't work the first time, but now it's apparently the thing to do. Yeah.
More guns.
Yeah, more guns is always the solution, apparently.
Okay, Hammer came around in a good part of my life. I was a teenage boy. My testosterone levels were starting to go up. And one of the things that was really neat about the Hammer movies, not only were you scared, but you got to see good-looking women.
Okay.
You know, and that was the highlight. That was important to me at that particular time. There was a period of time which probably did more of the scare factor, but the thing about the Hammer movies I remember from my ill-spent youth was you had sex. Now, it wasn't like filthy sex. You know, all it took, you know, is, oh, I saw the woman's calf. That's quite a bit right there. Oh, the bodice is down. Well, okay, we see her Adam's apple, but women don't have Adam's apples.
This is a Mennonite version of sexy.
Yeah, but, you know, it was kind of interesting, you know, and what was kind of cool about it is they had, like some of the other movie studios back then, they had a stable of people that worked for them, you know, and, you know, you had Christopher Lee, fantastic, probably the best Dracula out there.
I might fight you on the Bela Lugosi.
Well, Bela Lugosi's good, but another name comes to mind. Louis Jordan did a very good Count Dracula on a PBS special years ago, which is worth watching. But anyway, let's go back, but I digress. All right, and then here you are. We've got all of our little little teenage friends. You go to the drive-in movie, and we think, oh, my God, you know, you've got the vampire lovers with Ingrid Pitt. They go, whew. This is really cool. You know, of course, you wait for that 1 millisecond of something, you know, that whatever it takes to trip your trigger. But, you know, what we're getting at here is, you know, they gave us something new. And that's what sells.
So having hit the ground running, their next film was the sequel to Dracula. However, Dracula's not in it. They did manage to call it, though, Brides of Dracula.
Right.
Like a lot of the Hammer films, they name the film to sensationalize the subject matter, right. But Dracula's not in it.
But it was so successful. The horror of Dracula was so successful.
Yeah.
They were riding on the coattails of that.
Yeah. So they did bring back Peter Cushing as Van Helsing, but they sort of hold back his appearance until it's going to make the most impact. We do get a young woman going through the areas of Transylvania. She's right. On her way to a teaching gig.
I've got my first appointment there as a student teacher. I start tomorrow, and I did not want to give a bad impression by arriving late.
Her carriage takes off without her.
Right.
And she gets offered to be put up the evening in pretty swanky digs.
Yeah.
Castle on the Hill.
I can't take you over tonight, but I shall see that you get there early in the morning. Meantime, you cannot stay in a poor place like this.
There is nowhere else.
Indeed there is. I'm the Baroness Meinster. My castle is in the hills, just above the village.
Yeah, and they're like warning her, but whatever. She's she's French and she doesn't understand what's going on, apparently.
So the old woman who offers her overnight accommodations and I guess dinner. Do they have dinner? They do have
dinner. They have dinner. Yeah. She's eating dinner when she gets left.
Yes. And there's a really conspicuous entryway off center from the fireplace. And it's kind of the very classic, like, don't go in there.
Right.
Why would you? I don't know. Also that it's open is all kind of absurd. But there you go. Now she is in a mysterious castle. Where this old woman is kind of like overly friendly and
yeah, it's fine. It's a nice little situation kind of going on.
But she is told, like, you know, don't go wandering around.
Well, I mean, I would tell also people not to go wandering around my house because you're a stranger I just met.
Like, it needs to be said. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Have some goddamn manners. Act like you've been here before.
But yeah. No. So, I mean, I might tell her, like, don't touch my things. I don't like it.
So that night she takes a look on her balcony down.
Right.
This really is a pretty cool-looking castle and a pretty cool-looking set where below is another balcony.
Right, there's lots of balconies, and I like that.
And there's a dude looking out, and they kind of have sort of flirty eyes initially.
I thought I saw a man, a young man, but I must have been wrong.
You were not wrong. You saw my son.
But I thought...
You thought what I wanted you to think. But I was an old woman living here alone. Now you know that I am not alone. I have a son.
Please... I don't wish...
My son is ill.
I am so very sorry.
His illness has destroyed my peace of mind in these last years. You may not believe it, but we have had gay times here. Balls, dinners, life.
I am sure.
People used to come from all over Europe, even from Paris, to be my guest, until he ruined it all.
He ruined it all? How?
It hurt me too much not to be able to present my only child to my friends, to have to keep him locked up.
That's a warning. I mean, why not just like, yeah, he's a bad boy. You don't want any part of that.
It's yeah,
like,
exactly.
All right, she's going to go for him. Of
the
course
French lady's like, okay.
So the next time she goes out to the balcony, he's on the ledge and she's pretty sure he's going to try and commit suicide because why would you stand on the ledge?
Because that's weird. It's a weird thing to do. Don't do that.
So in like Florence Nightingale style, she tells him, don't. And she runs to find him and takes that conspicuous door entryway next to the fireplace and goes and finds him and discovers that he's chained to the wall.
But it's inhuman.
My mother thinks of me as inhuman, doesn't she? I suppose she's told you that I'm mad. Well, I have to be locked away like this for everybody's sake.
And he's very handsome.
Yes, the Baron is very handsome.
Is a like blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy who doesn't look evil.
No, he's a very handsome fellow that doesn't look like he could murder people.
But of course, like she goes through the old woman's room, finds the key, goes through the trouble of throwing it to him. He unlocks himself. Right.
Which is the dumbest thing, throwing him that key, because that could have gone really, really wrong. And she knows already how to get into his room. Go give him the key. Don't throw the only key that you know will get him away from the wall.
He'd have to gnaw his own leg off.
Yeah, what are you doing? What are you doing? That's what when she ties the key in the handkerchief and throws it over.
Yeah.
It's the worst idea I've ever seen in a movie.
But it's funny that he doesn't, I don't know why it drew attention, but he doesn't even try and catch it. He watches it sail by him. And then picks it up off the floor. It's like they had one take and he was like, I don't want to fuck this up by trying to catch it and watching it go between my hands.
It might have been something like that, honestly. It really might have, because it is stupid, because you're just like, you could have caught. It's like Daria. She's like sticks his hand out, like, but he doesn't even stick his hand out to catch the, you know, like in Daria when she's playing volleyball and she sticks her hand out. That he just like watches it sail by like, yep. You know what he's thinking? He's thinking like, you could have come over here and fucking handed me that key, you bitch.
So not long after, the old woman, and I thought it was a great reveal, where the old woman realizes that like, you set him free.
Right.
I assure you, madam, I have no key.
You must have it. Give it to me. Give it to me.
Leave me alone.
You haven't taken it to my son. You little fool. You don't know what you've done. You don't know what you've done.
And I love that moment of like, oh shit, like you've just unleashed some real evil into this world.
Right, you messed up, dude.
Yeah, and it turns out that the mother was doing the world a service
by
locking up her son.
That was kind of nice of her. Except for she was feeding him.
Yeah, it seemed like she was doing the bare minimum of murder to keep him. I mean, by luring people to the castle.
You know.
Yeah, but... You know, I mean, in this day and age, like vampires would be drinking synthetic blood and eating, you know, raw steaks or whatever. So that was kind of
fair enough.
Yeah. In lieu of a butcher nearby, she was kind of doing the work.
You've done what you could for him since then. God help you. Keeping him here a prisoner, bringing these young girls to him, keeping them alive with their blood. But the powers of darkness are too strong. They've beaten you. He's free. He'll come back here. That's certain. He'll come back to his old Greta. He'll come.
Further into the story, we get the reveal of Peter Cushing coming back as Van Helsing, checking necks again. Mm-hmm.
Yes, as he does. He's just like obsessed with people's necks.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's the one skill he's got. Although, back to the business card gag, this time around, someone reads off his business card.
My dear Dr. Van Helsing, you had only to tell me. Heavens, how could I be expected to recognize a doctor of philosophy, a doctor of theology, a professor of metaphysics by the cut of his trousers?
Because why not?
Why not? I mean, as long as you're writing shit on a business card.
Yeah, I mean, that's at the end of the day, like, you're writing your business card and everyone believes what you say. Like,
yeah, you've gone through all this trouble.
I'm a surgeon as well.
I'm a doctor. I specialize in neck checking.
Yeah. I'm a neckologist. Neckology, it's new.
But I love the gravitas that he brings with him. And I couldn't wait to have him enter the story. And when he does, like, he's bringing the full force of a fucking vampire hunter.
Mm-hmm.
He encounters a young woman who's died. They're having the service. He checks the neck. There she is. She's been sucked on. She's going into... Weird, but I put that.
Yeah, that is weird.
But
it's Hammer Films and everything's sexy. So there you go.
So she's to be buried that night, and he knows that it's not going to be long before she comes back.
Right.
So he, you know, it's an old-fashioned stakeout. And one of the creep...
puns there.
Totally didn't mean that. But one of the creepiest moments in this movie... is one of the vampire assistants, the ghouls, what do they call the living assistants?
Like a harbinger, kind of, like a Renfield kind of character?
Yeah.
Yeah, like a harbinger.
So one of the harbingers is sitting on the grave, whispering to it.
Nice.
And like, you know, come back to me, my pretty, and you know, just sort of like, leading the way follow my voice.
Weird.
It's great. That audio is really unsettling. And then you sort of pull back and see that Van Helsing's eyeing this whole thing. And it's even more creepy because you know that like that ground is going to start pushing up
and it
does. So when she does come out of the ground, he pounces. He's been working with the local priest. They lose track though. And
it's a bad stakeout. He's having a bad time.
Doesn't really do a good job. For as prepared as they were, not all that prepared.
No, not so good.
This is followed by the vampire bat attack.
Right, which you had a great story about that, which explains it.
In the Lugosi Dracula, the squeaky bat.
Yes, that talks to her, which I love. I do love that scene when she's like, squeak, squeak. What was that? Squeak, squeak, squeak. Oh, no.
So only slightly better than the Lugosi squeaky bat. This time, the prop department put a lot of effort into making a realistic model bat. It got lost and had to be replaced on short notice. This explains the rather unconvincing look of the model that got used in the movie.
Which is a giant, giant bat.
Yeah, it kind of looks like... I don't know, like a hairy sausage with wings. It's
a pterodactyl-sized bat.
Yeah, and I don't remember if you can see the strings, but it was just so, ugh. You really felt bad. And later in the movie, it actually attacks somebody, and the bat specifically kills the guy.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Well, you could see then a bat that size could kill somebody.
Yeah, I mean, just by blunt force trauma.
Just like zooming in.
Also, keep in mind that this... followed the agreement with Universal, so now they had a little wiggle room in terms of duplicating dynamics.
Right.
So in the first of these, we heard Peter Cushing explain that all that stuff about vampires transubstantiating into different animals, bats and wolves
and
whatnot.
True.
Yeah, in this time, we're not going to mention it. We're just going to look the other way while a giant vampire bat attacks dudes.
Right, right. Yeah, because Arthur says in the first one, like, can't they turn into bats? And Van Helsing's like, no, you're crazy.
Right. That myth is entirely wrong. It's a myth.
You're insane, sir. I really wanted to figure out a place to make a not another stakeout joke. And now I'm like, really, like there's nowhere to put it. So
the Emilio Estevez movie?
Yes, because you had said stakeout. And then I wrote it when you said that, then I wrote down a note like, this is going to be a really funny joke. I'm going to say not another stakeout sometime. And I haven't been able to work it into the conversation. So I just blurted it out. So you know how clever I am.
Okay, so jumping ahead on Van Helsing's investigation, he winds up back at the castle. He's sort of putting the story together of...
Not another stakeout.
Yikes. So he runs into the Baroness.
Yeah.
She has, in a weird incestuous move, has been turned into a vampire by her son.
Yes.
And he, you know, she kind of comes to terms with, like, Van Helsing's here to kill me.
Yes.
And he
She's
does.
Okay with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oddly, he waits till sunrise to do it. Like, he's just kind of hanging out with her, and there you go. There's your second stakeout. But,
damn it.
This is the first time there is an on-camera stake to the chest. Right. And again, it's in the sternum, whatever. But it is bloody.
Instead of the cutaway that they've been, yeah.
Yeah, this is a direct hit on camera. And it just struck me as, like, really violent. From there, we have the sort of interjected comic relief of the local doctor who's trying to cure himself. He feels like he's coming down with a cold. So it is a long scene where he's, like, self-medicating with brandy and pills.
I didn't understand why I had to watch that.
It segued into him saying, there's something going wrong up the hill at the school where now our first French lady is teaching.
Ago.
Right. It's a long way to get there. And it is really ineffective comic relief. But we do arrive at the point where he says that a girl, turns out the roommate of our leading lady, has just died out of nowhere.
Yeah,
and he goes,
surprise.
I don't want to catch death like they did up the hill. And Van Helsing's, you know, in the same bar and overhears them and goes, take me to that place. Cut to that place. Him and the vampire Baron have their showdown. Vampire Baron is still very, maybe a sexier vampire villain than Christopher Lee's Dracula.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah.
So Van Helsing sort of gets the woman away from him. And in a great finale, they really do, like, they set some shit on fire. Mm-hmm. The vampire knocks his crucifix away from
it's
him.
It's a pretty good action scene. There's a lot of action in this movie.
Van Helsing burns his face with holy water.
Yeah, why
it's
not?
It's fucking, like, it's a toss-up. Like, they really go at it. And they eventually wind up, like, up on a windmill tower.
Yeah.
It's a little Frankenstein-esque from the first one.
Wondering where that came from, that windmill.
It seemed like a great plot, like, plot setting that they were like, we got to find a way to use this because it's fucking rad.
Yeah, they're
Van
like,
Helsing,
we found this.
You don't know what he's doing at first. Vampires on ground level. Van Helsing is, like, lit by the midnight moon.
Right.
Reaches up, grabs, like, you're not even sure that it's a windmill.
Right, right.
He grabs this, like, cloth-covered structure and pulls it down. You think he's going to swing down or some shit.
I thought he was going to be, like, in Three Musketeers kind of style thing going on. But that didn't happen. No.
No, he pulls it down so that it's perpendicular again.
Uh-huh, watch out for those lines.
Vampires hate perpendicular crosses. And casts a crucifix shadow on our Baron, and that's the killing stroke. It is the biggest crucifix any vampires had to face, and that does him in. Roll credits, because it's a monster movie,
right,
and evil has been thwarted. But I love that ending. I really love that ending.
It's absurd, though. Like, you have to agree that it's just absurd. The windmill's just out of nowhere, and it is absurd. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Still awesome.
Okay,
still
fair
really
enough.
Cool
fair
to
enough.
See on screen.
It just, like, gets to be, like, running away, frantic shenanigans keep happening at the end, which I guess is exciting, and probably in that time, like, it was
very finale.
Exciting.
I thought all the buildup was a really well orchestrated. Again, like, maybe they're shoehorning that sort of that killing blow, but I really dug it. And, you know, it's Peter Cushing.
I just wish there could have been something with the mother-son killing duo, like. I think there could have been something really, like, fucked up and dark about the two of them.
Even an encounter where, like, maybe you kind of face the tragedy of, like, you've been trying to save me from the world, but you couldn't even save yourself. And
right.
Here, and he bites her neck or something.
I really thought there could be something there.
Add to that tragedy.
Because to me, that's the most interesting part, is this mother-son duo. And it's very strange in that she's hiding this monster.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. To me, nowadays, I think people would use that. That would be where the story would go.
Yeah, I can see that.
But then in Hammer, because they're trying really to push sex and violence.
Oh, and at that point, it was also, I think they made it through like 15, 20 minutes of the movie, and Peter Cushing as Van Helsing hadn't appeared.
Right.
So they were just kind of, yeah, let's get to it. Let's get to it.
Right. Would you say that you were like rooting more for Dracula than anyone? I mean, you know, were you rooting for the bad guy maybe more in Hammer films than clearly there's a cut and dry in Universal? There's good guy, bad guy.
You felt sorry for him.
Okay.
Example would be Curse of the Werewolf at Oliver Reed. This guy, he's bitten by a wolf, okay? Makes him a werewolf, a good-looking werewolf, because Oliver Reed's a pretty good-looking guy. And, you know, you feel sorry for him. You know, he's stuck in a situation he can't get out of. Uh-huh. You know, and, of course, the very end, he has to die in the story. Ya-ta-ta.
You just, spoiler alert.
Well, this movie was done in, we're talking about, well, my memory serves me correct, 1961, so if it's a spoiler alert.
It's too bad.
Yeah, something's not right. Something's not right at all. Well, would you stop and you think about it, though? The others are cut and dry. They were kind of like passion plays, you know, mm-hmm. morality plays. Yeah, here's the monster, kill it, end of story, bam, bam. And now all of a sudden we're moving into a thing where, oh, wait a minute, let's rethink this a little bit here. You know, like some people thought in Paradise Lost by Milton that maybe Lucifer might have been the hero of that story,
right.
You know? But they got you to think, and that was the fun part. You know, they were fun films. They weren't overly laden with blood. Yeah, you got to see a little bit of, I don't know, might have been raspberry. It could have been Hershey syrup run down the corner of Christopher Lee's mouth. And he get that wild-eyed stare. And, you know, wow, that's pretty cool.
This next one, also directed by Terrence Fisher, however, devoid of our Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee combo, mm-hmm. is The Curse of the Werewolf. And this is 1961, based on the novel Werewolf in Paris. The story kind of details the original werewolf curse, or at least one instance where the curse starts from scratch.
Okay.
And it harkens back to hundreds of years ago where people were terrified of anything happening to pregnant women. Pregnant women were kind of treated a little bit like delicate flowers, but at the same time, there was a nervousness around them that anything could make their child into a stark raving maniac, a killer,
right.
Anything could make it go wrong. And in this case, at its inception, everything goes wrong. According to the documentary Flesh and Blood, The Hammer Heritage of Horror, the Spanish setting for this film was forced on the writer Anthony Hines after Michael Carreras had the studio backlot dress for a film about the Spanish Inquisition. This film was not produced because the Catholic League of Decency threatened to ban
it. Nice. And Anthony Hines, for location for filming, he said that they could go anywhere as long as you could walk from Bray Studios to wherever you could walk, you could go and use that location, which is why they use Oakley Court, because it was right next door. So that's why you see that big Gothic mansion, because they could walk there. So if you could walk there, you could do it. If there was something already on your lot, you could still walk there. You better use it.
Yeah. So this one, while it was a big studio, it did sort of open up and there's quite a few exteriors, but I don't know. It really seems as random as I just described for a werewolf movie.
Yeah.
All right. So pretty early on, they introduce a guy who is jailed up by the local landowner. His only crime is really like being homeless. And they lock him up because he's of no use local.
It's New York City now. Excellent.
It's illegal to be homeless. So he's in the tower. The only person who's nice to him is kind of the jailer, but really the jailer's daughter. And so she grows up, and this guy doesn't like take the kindness of a stranger and maintain. He just gets crazier and batty.
Okay. All right.
So now crazy homeless guy is faced with the grown-up
pretty young woman okay. who was the only nice person to him. He rewards her by raping her.
Oh, good. Thank
and
you.
And impregnating her.
Oh, excellent. It's even better. See, I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad you said I didn't have to watch this movie.
So almost in the tradition, this would be interesting down the line if I'm the only one who watches the werewolf movies. Mm-hmm. And I feel...
I think maybe you should. I think you've taken that upon yourself.
Well, it's a bummer that the werewolf movies that we've covered... not good.
Yeah,
I mean, this isn't a bad movie. It's just slow, and it doesn't have Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, so I couldn't really be all that invested. It has Oliver Reed, but he comes with his own complications later. But it's just, I don't know. It's slow and not all that compelling. It starts off on this really weird note of crazy guy rapes a girl.
Right.
And she is impregnated and gives birth to this... cursed child.
Wait, why though? Because she was raped. Now the child has a curse.
Yep.
Oh, okay, good.
That's all it takes back then. Yeah. That really is it. She kills the local baron and flees. She's pregnant at the time. She gives birth after, you know, two people have sort of taken her in. She's a mute this whole time. So she is not fully capable of relaying the horrors that have faced her life.
Fair enough.
She, you know, the local baron, like, made moves on her, and she was...
She didn't say anything, so he thought she wasn't interested.
silence is not consent, y'all. But that's why she winds up trapped with the crazy guy. Now these people have taken her in. Mm-hmm. The woman recognizes that she is quite pregnant. They sort of give her house and home for a little while. She gives birth to the kid and dies shortly after in a really weird move. Like, she's there because she's a pretty face. I have a feeling she was a terrible actress, so they said, your character's mute.
Yeah, you don't need to talk.
She's in very low-cut dresses.
Excellent,
and that's clearly why. Like, she is a beauty, but she's really just there for one reason. After she dies, after the birth, now we have our protagonist.
Okay.
And from the time he's a child, something's up. There are sheep that go, you know, not missing, but dead. They just show up dead, and people are complaining. They think it's the local farmer's dog who did it. And
that's horrible.
Really, he's just displaying serial killer tendencies in terms of, like, killing small animals. There's a kitten that they talk about being just gutted.
Oh, he's like a little tiny serial killer in training.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay.
And when he talks about, like, being found out of bed, everything's a dream to him. Like, he doesn't realize he's doing it himself. So his sort of now adopted parents recognize that, like, something is fucking up with this kid.
Okay.
And they realize that, like, he's the one who's killing all the animals. And they realize that, like, he's the werewolf to be. But I don't know if it's part of the curse or they just realize that he can keep it under wraps.
There are elemental spirits about us at all times, my son. Spirits without bodies of creatures that have never lived. And some say it is to prevent the invasion of these roaming spirits into the highest creation of God's sculpturing hands, the body of man, before whom all beasts must kneel. And some say it is to prevent this invasion that man's body stiffens into rigor mortis at the moment of his death. A roaming spirit entering the body then finds only a dry, unwelcoming shell.
But... Father.
Now, you're wondering what this has to do with little Leon.
Yes.
I'll tell you, my son. Sometimes it so happens that the spirit of one of these beasts finds entrance into a body while it yet lives, usually at the moment of birth. Then the soul and the spirit war with each other to gain mastery of the body. But if the soul of the man is strong and clean, it will generally exorcise the spirit of the beast before it is many years old. But if for some reason the soul is weak, an inherited weakness, an accident of birth, then... A werewolf. For that is what he is, my son. A werewolf is a body with a soul and a spirit that are constantly at war. The spirit is that of a wolf. And whatever weakens the human soul, vice, greed, hatred, solitude, especially during the cycle of the full moon when the forces of evil are at their strongest, these bring the spirit of the wolf to the fore. And in turn, whatever weakens the spirit of the beast, warmth, fellowship, love, raise the human soul. Now, little Leon has no real father or mother, and yet he needs their love and care far more than any normal child.
I understand, Father, and I shall do my best to replace that love.
I know you will, my son.
But is there no cure?
Only love. When he's older, he may meet a young girl whom he will love very deeply. But what is more important, she should love him very deeply. Then he may be saved.
This is kind of how Oz does that in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
He like becomes very zen and then...
Yeah, he has to be. He's like the Incredible Hulk, really. And Oliver Reed plays that more where when he leaves home, his parents sort of tell him, like, and remember, keep your shit together. Like,
right. Don't Hulk out.
So, of course, you know, he falls in love with the local lady, but she's betrothed.
My name is Christina Fernando.
And they fall in love together. It's kind of like if Braveheart were a werewolf, where Mel Gibson, you know... I guess in real life, he has a couple drinks and becomes a monster.
It's true.
He falls in love with this woman he can't have. And that's enough to kind of steer him up. All of a sudden, his calm is lost.
You know, that's ladies always turning you into a monster because they're so sexy and they shouldn't dress like that. Exactly. It's really all their fault, probably.
He's very poor. He's working in a very utilitarian position. His roommate, though, is a party guy. His roommate is Oliver Reed. So he's like, you're going to get all the ladies. We're going to go to a bar where there are dancing ladies. And we're totally going to get laid and drunk. It's going to be awesome. Oliver Reed should know better. He knows that this is a recipe for disaster.
But he wants to have a good time.
He does. So he follows. He has some drinks. He goes, he goes home with the woman. And he does so because he's, like, feeling faint. He knows something's going on. But he lets this woman take him home.
Mm-hmm.
And... they start necking, and, you know, it's 1961. It's a little scandalous. He bites her.
Excellent.
Like, on camera, Oliver Reed.
This is like when you're drinking a lot and you feel like you might throw up, but then you're like, no, I still want to keep having a good time. And then you're like, yeah, I'll try. Let's go home. Let's see.
Go home, Oliver Reed. You're drunk.
And you're just like, maybe I can get through this encounter without throwing up.
And that's doubly sad because Oliver Reed is an infamous alcoholic.
Oh, now I sound like an asshole. So anyway, he knew how to play this because he knew that feeling.
So he bites her. That kind of really gets him going. He straight up attacks her and just breaking shit in the room. Some of it happens in shadow. It's quite violent. And from what I understand...
And he's a big guy.
Yeah, and Oliver Reed's like a stocky.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a tall, heavy dude.
Yeah, he's a big fella.
His roommate, I think, comes to find this, and his roommate gets it too. And this happens in shadow, where he tosses his roommate around like a fucking rag doll.
Nice.
And he's clearly monstering out.
Because he should have put a sock on the door.
He's not. That's perfect. That's... Oliver Reed's character, going back, his character's name is Leon.
Leon Corrido.
Yeah, because this is all in Spain. They literally give his transformation hairy palms. And this happens even as a child. So there might be some sexual innuendo there in terms of warning children, don't masturbate, you'll get hairy palms.
Right.
Oliver Reed, it's hands first.
Nice.
If you remember, I talked about it in the Lon Chaney Jr. Wolfman. It's a legs sort of under the slacks transformation
where
we see him get hairy legs and then Twinkle Toes step out of the room. In this case, it's Oliver Reed's hairy hands.
Perfect. Excellent.
So, of course, now there's two dead people. Oliver Reed is sort of accused by the local authorities, and it, of course, it that's the only real drama and action in the movie is when he's arrested and things start going bad. So he's visited. It becomes apparent that, yeah, his mistress is, she's the wealthy landowner's daughter, and it's all verboten. And his next transformation where he escapes prison, that's the good one.
Okay.
This one, the closest image, it's funny, Hammer made a bunch of monster movies. They only made one werewolf movie.
Wow.
And I will say the last act of this movie is enough. It's good.
Okay.
Everything up to this, a little slow. The last third is solid. His transformation is akin to, do you remember in Monster Squad?
Okay. You always go back to Monster Squad, I feel.
Wolfman has nards. That Wolfman, pretty good Wolfman. I mean, it was iconic that, like, when his shoes get sort of exploded out,
right?
His toes. So that Wolfman was great, and it's based on this one. It's based on Oliver Reed's Wolfman. So he spends the last third sort of breaking out of prison, looking for his woman, but, like, you know, killing anybody who gets in between. The townspeople, you know, cue them with pitchforks and torches, and they sort of track him down to one particular building, and he's sort of howling at the moon and going mad. It's like early days of parkour. We get to see him, you know, scale some buildings, and that's impressive.
Nice. Yeah.
His dad is seemingly the only one who knows that, like, there's no coming back from this. Mm-hmm. My son, he's let the monster out.
Right.
And there's no, you know, there's no getting in that demon back in the
bottle. He doesn't want to, like, actually do the therapeutic work to get this back together.
That's too much time, too much work.
Too much work.
He's got a day job. So he does acquire a silver bullet. He takes his rifle. He goes up to the church tower, and there the bells are ringing, and the Wolfman's kind of going nuts because...
Okay, it hurts really his ears. Yeah, sure.
His big pointy ears, it hurts him.
He can hear really well, probably. He's a dog.
Yeah.
Right.
Or wolf, as it would be.
Whatever, same shit.
So that's where the sort of climax happens between father and son. Mm. And you kind of, yeah, you feel bad, but at least it was his dad who takes him out. And that's it. And then Oliver Reed's dead. And end of movie. It's not the best of these. And I feel bad that that's the note that we're ending on. But it was, you know, I would say jump to the last third of...
I mean, I would say that
Curse
that's...
of the Werewolf.
That's Hammer kind of in general. There's, like, great parts and then surrounded by, like, kind of garbage.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see.
It comes and goes. It's very inconsistent with, like, the brilliant parts, you know, being brilliant. I really did love The Mummy, and I love certain aspects of the Dracula film. Yeah. But then I had to watch the other parts. And I guess it just wasn't for me.
Yeah, well, that's fair. So Christopher Lee died earlier this year, and... talk about a guy with the resume. There's an internet meme of his accomplishments, and it reads like some historical, like almost historical fiction, that not all these things could happen to
guy. Like a superhero.
But he led that kind of life. So it says Christopher Lee, he was Dracula, he was a Bond villain, he was Sherlock and Mycroft Holmes, he was Death, he was Lucifer, he was Count Dooku, he was Saruman, he was Lord Summerisle. He recorded a heavy metal concept album about Charlemagne. He was fluent in English, Italian, French, German, and Spanish, and, quote, moderately proficient in Swedish, Russian, and Greek, and conversational in Mandarin Chinese. He hunted Nazis during World War II. He was part of a secret agent unit called the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. On the set of Lord of the Rings, when told by Peter Jackson to imagine how a man being stabbed in the back sounds, he told him he didn't have to imagine it. Mm. Christopher Lee was a bad motherfucker, and he will be missed. So that's just the entry into the Hammer monster movies, and later down the line we'll go into all the other non-monster movies that Hammer made, because there's a lot there to sort of dig through. They really did have their heyday, and it's too bad that they kind of fell apart and didn't really
you know, adjust with time, but hey man, what's there is great.
Right. And it's inspired, you know, a lot of people who we think of now, you know, modern horror now, and even Mario Bava is inspired by Dracula. He was inspired by the success of Dracula and says, wow, I can actually make a movie that's going to make some return to me. So he makes Black Sunday. And so what you have when this English, when Hammer started, you have them really inspiring other houses in other countries. And so you have Italian horror because you had English horror.
Yeah. And it seemed like put him out of business, sort of.
I mean, essentially it did, because this is now Italy's doing sexy horror in a way that England's still doing the old fashioned style at that time. And Italy's really moving forward. America jumps into the fray. Smart horror like Rosemary's Baby kind of, and The Exorcist really kind of puts the nail in the coffin for these, because
so to speak,
because it's a different style of horror. And I think your horror fan at that point in time has now evolved to see different kind of stories and can do more than monsters and sci-fi horror and kind of wants to see the next big thing.
So that's it for this episode, The Monsters of Hammer. We'll return to Hammer Film Productions down the line, but this was an intense one.
Yeah. And I'm glad I watched them, though.
Yeah, me too. I've really enjoyed them way more than I expected to.
I might not have loved every single one, but the gold was gold, you know, in there. So I'm glad I watched it, I think.
Yeah. So, dig those up. A lot of them you'll have to find by questionable means. They're not as easy to find as they should be.
There's an entire anthology on Amazon.
Okay.
Of, I think, all Hammer films.
Oh, terrific.
So that's, you know, right there on Amazon. I think it's on Prime even. Free shipping, bitches.
Okay, so that's it for this episode of The Rants Macabre. If you're listening to this, you found us on either Stitcher, iTunes, or our website. So recommend us to a friend. Share the word, give us a review on whichever outlet you found us on, and get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Rants Macabre, and the website is therantsmacabre.com. And we've always got bonus content and regular updates. So that's it for me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks. You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.